Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Greg Sheridan makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, and thanks to the NAB for providing this fine facility this evening in Sydney. Greg is here on the occasion of the launch of his book, When We Were Young and Foolish, a memoir of my misguided youth with Tony Abbott, Bob Carr, Malcolm Turnbull, Kevin Rudd and other reprobates. And Janet Grundy's got copies of that. Greg's well known to you. I will introduce him briefly and then come up with what I hope is my scoop. As Greg outlines in his book, he was a student activist, a trade union official and a journalist since 1979, initially at the Bulletin and since 1984, of course, at the Australian, where you're currently foreign editor. Now, my scoop is that Rupert Murdoch has just sent out the following tweet, thanks to Dimitri who showed it to us. Greg Sheridan's When We Were Young and Foolish, great yarn about youthful friends Abbott, Turnbull, Rudd and Carr, Irish Catholic Sydney. So, your boss is right onto this. So, well done, Rupert. And, Greg, welcome to talk to us about When We Were Young and Foolish. Thank you.
Well, Jared and Anne, ladies and gentlemen, God bless Rupert. You can understand why I love him so much. And I don't know if some of you are aware of his long career as a literary critic. Thanks. Indeed, but what a brilliant review it was. I'd also like to thank NAB for hosting this function tonight. I think NAB has a certain personal interest in student politics in a bygone era. I'd particularly like to thank Jared and Anne for putting this function on and for all the work they do in the Sydney Institute. You won't believe it looking at Jared's youthful mien, but Jared is actually a little older than I am. As a young fellow, Jared was one of the people I looked up to and admired and to some extent wanted to emulate. But you have to admire, if nothing else, my rank courage or foolishness. Imagine giving a talk which is going to be in large measure about BA Santa Maria and the National Civic Council to an audience which includes Jared Henderson. This is just ridiculous, you know. Journalists like to give broad brush, impressionistic disquisitions to audiences with no knowledge of detail and well prepared only in popular prejudice, which we like to encourage and reinforce. The idea of someone who is really a scholar in the field that you're talking about is frightful. However, there you go, into the dens of lions. Now, I'm going to talk for another 25 minutes or so, and I recall a comment Adlai Stevenson made in a very similar situation to this. For the next 25 minutes or so, it's my job to talk, it's your job to listen. If you should happen to finish your job before I finish my job, no hard feelings whatsoever. Completely relaxed about that. Now, I don't want to obviously talk about my book, When We Were Young and Foolish. My poor wife, Jacy, who is in the front row here, has been subjected to a great deal of talking about this book. She knows all of its anecdotes much better than she ever wanted to know them, and she is the only person who has the power of the blue pen. I don't know if the Henderson marriage is like that, that either member of the couple can censor the writings of the other, but the long and the short of it is, if you find anything I'm about to say foolish, excessive, extreme, irresponsible, ridiculous, or just plain downright dumb, I want you to approach Jacy and she will deal with you. I want to talk a little bit, obviously, about the book, about why I wrote it, and a bit about what it contains. Now, writing a memoir is, of course, a very self-indulgent thing to do. And I hasten to suggest that my life in public affairs is not worthy in itself of a memoir. You know, I'm not a prime minister, I'm not a foreign minister, I'm not a movie star or the sort of person who about whom people are interested. But I do believe that there was a value in trying to capture a certain time and place in Sydney and Australia, in our recent past and in our political past, which I think hadn't really been done justice properly in much literature. And that partly that is because of the way the National Civic Council had been substantially disappeared from our history. I'll come to that a bit more a bit later. But also I did want to explain the worldview that I've developed over these nearly 60 years that I've been on the earth, and it's perhaps a minority worldview, and so I wanted to explain how I came to that worldview and then offer a defence of that worldview. Part of that worldview includes a view about religion. Now, I'm just old enough to have been schooled in journalism in the period when there was a strong tradition of Australian secularism, which didn't mean that religion was banished altogether from public life, but it did mean that we Catholics and our Protestant friends would agree not to fight with each other all the time, so that life would be manageable for us and the Protestants and for everybody else. And for a long time I respected that and therefore never wrote about any issue touching on religious belief or practice. But the culture became so militantly secular and so anti-religious and so hostile to any religious view of human nature or human life or human purpose, that in time I came to the view, for myself at least, I don't enjoin anyone else to this view, that if you have a religious view and you don't talk about it, when you're a general bloviator, when you talk about everything, if you just cut that aspect of life out and don't talk about it, it's a first cousin or it's a species of cowardice, really. And I think people who do have a religious view of life ought to at least be able to claim minority rights. You know, perhaps the anti-discrimination legislation could be amended to include us, so that while you can lampoon and mock us and so forth, at least we have to get our, you know, 1 or 2% of public airtime or something like this. In any event, part of the book does explain what I believe, for what it's worth, religiously, and partly also because for a person of my generation, religious belief and political belief were often intertwined. They certainly were in my case. And then the final ambition of the book was to try to tell a few jokes and give people a smile. You know, I identify very closely with Malcolm Muggeridge's adaptation of Keats' "Tread Softly, for You Tread on My Jokes." And I hope the book has a degree of good humour and a degree of humour in it. So the synopsis of the story, for what it's worth, is that I grew up in inner western Sydney in a normal working class family. Father was a clerk, my mother didn't work outside the home. There were four kids. We had a little sister who died as well, so there were five kids overall, but four for most of my childhood. And the first political event I recall was the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which meant a great deal to us as inner Sydney Catholics in 1963. It happened on the same date as my seventh birthday, but because of time differences, it didn't happen while I was having my birthday party or anything like that. And it was a very big event for us because we felt, at least in my little Catholic ghetto in inner western Sydney, and where I lived in Lewisham, it was a bit of a Catholic ghetto. There were two Christian Brothers schools, a nuns' school, a very big parish church with a Monsignor and three curates, a Catholic hospital. When I was a little kid, I looked at all these big institutions and I thought the church was the great world. That was the great world. We didn't have a TV or a car when I was young. We walked everywhere and a lot of our life centred on the church. When the president was assassinated, we felt to some extent that it was our president. And we felt very proud of John F. Kennedy. We felt about him in the way Africans feel about Barack Obama, that he demonstrated that one of our people could be the best person in the world, and there was nothing to no one you could admire more than the president. In that same year, I also began listening to the weekly broadcasts of BA Santa Maria on Point of View. Now, when my father had been active in BA Santa Maria's movement in Sydney, he'd been active in trade unions, in the groups, in the industrial groups, trying to break communist control of the trade unions. After he died, I discovered a lot of union tickets for unions, which he never ever worked in the trade, you know. And in fact, he used to go along to these union meetings and also to some sectarian Protestant meetings to try to get them to change tack or whatever. But he would always get thrown out because he would never shut up. And the instruction was to be quiet and vote the right way. Well, he could vote the right way, but he never got to stay till the vote because he was always thrown out. And he was at a painters and decorators union. I have somewhere his painters and decorators union card, although in fact he was a clerk. And he was heckling the left-wing union official who was speaking. And a fellow turned round and said to him, "Show us your hands, you've never been a painter in your life." And three burly blokes threw him out. So I had a lot to live up to in Dad's inheritance. But we felt that the church was being persecuted by the communists in the Soviet Union, in Eastern Europe and China. And it wasn't a strictly sectarian concern. We felt that a great chunk of humanity was being persecuted by communists. And it was our job to fight against the communists and to reduce their influence. Another motive for writing the book is that Australians have kind of forgotten about the Cold War, and there's no accountability in the Cold War. All the people in Australia who supported the communists are kind of lauded and celebrated as great heroes, as though they were fighting for equal rights for women cleaners in hospitals or something like this, whereas in fact they were supporting, often very actively, the despotisms of Stalin and Mao and later Pol Pot in Cambodia. So anyway, listening to Santa Maria every Sunday morning. Sunday mornings was a wonderful ritual for me. We'd go to 10 o'clock Mass at St. Thomas's Church at Lewisham, come home and watch the World of Sport, which was all about rugby league with Ron Casey. Then you'd watch Vincent Cervantes' Nature's Walkabout. I had a pretty defective imagination as a kid. I thought all history and all nature occurred in black and white, because we only, when we acquired a TV, it was naturally a black and white TV. And then we'd watch World Championship Wrestling with Mario Milano and Killer Kowalski and the hopeless Larry O'Day, the poor dopey Australian who always got beaten. And then the highlight of Sundays was watching BA Santa Maria's Point of View. And this does weigh on your psyche over time. If you watch Santa year after year after year, I mean, I think Santa was a great man. He was right about the big issue of his time, which was communism. But he certainly didn't underestimate dangers. You'd have to say that. He certainly was not guilty of gross understatement. And listening to Santa week after week, it was always 1 minute to midnight, and the enemy was always at our second last line of defences. Although, mind you, a lot of the things Santa said at the time bear an uncanny cadence today, I think, or have a certain rhyme today. I remember one of his great lines about the right wing of the ALP was, it said that the right wing of the ALP says to the left, "You can have the policies so long as we have the jobs." And it seems that that's coming back a bit, that formulation. In any event, in the last couple of years of high school, I got very active in Santa Maria's organisation, and I had a year in a Catholic seminary training to be a Redemptorist priest. They were great fellows. I didn't leave thinking that they hadn't recognised my genius and that I was too good for them and they weren't good enough for me. I left feeling, how on earth did they put up with me for a whole year? It's a miracle. And also with a certain feeling of gratitude of having had a year with these brilliant men, many of whom had Roman doctorates and so on. But I came back to Sydney as a teenager. My father had qualified as an accountant. We'd moved from working class Lewisham to very middle class Forestville, certainly moved up the social scale a few rungs. And I actually joined the Liberal Party to help William McMahon fight against Gough Whitlam, because I thought Whitlam was favouring the communists in Vietnam and there was altogether too much communist influence in the Labor Party. So this is the first sign of deep eccentricity, joining the Liberal Party in order to support William McMahon. I think it prefigured my friendship with Tony Abbott, because the only time he'd ever voted Labor in his life was voting for Barry Unsworth, and he nearly joined the Labor Party to support Barry Unsworth. Now, a lot of people joined the Labor Party because of Gough Whitlam, a lot of people because of Bob Hawke. Not many because of Barry Unsworth. Although I also had a very high opinion of Barry Unsworth, and his ultimate defeat was the defeat of an ideal for me, which was that a socially conservative Catholic could lead the Labor Party to electoral success. But in any event, I got involved in the Liberal Party to oppose Gough, handed out how to vote cards for Billy McMahon. He went down to his screaming defeat. And then in 73 and 74, I became very active in the National Civic Council. For 74, I went to work for them full-time for a few months. So in the election of 1974, I handed out how to vote cards for Jack Kane of the Democratic Labor Party. He's a great guy, fantastic guy, Jack. And as I reveal in my book, Tony Abbott more or less ghostwrote Jack's memoirs. And then I went to Sydney University and met Tony Abbott, who became really my best friend. I can't claim that I was his best friend. He probably had more friends than I did. But he was certainly my best friend. I met him in the most auspicious of circumstances. We both ran for class representative of Economics 1, Sydney University. Sydney University had two strands of economics, Marxist and mathematics. And if you didn't interpret the world either through mathematical symbols or Marxist symbols, there was nowhere else for you. And in terms of style, I was a natural in the Marxist stream. I mean, I was a literary, neurotic geek, you know, with long hair and a beard, and never saw a reason to go to bed at night, never saw a reason to get up in the morning, spent all my time reading books. But I couldn't stand their politics. In the mathematics class, there were all these clever people who were doing integral calculus and so forth. Mind you, they were describing reality almost as inaccurately as the Marxists were, thinking that you could reduce society to a series of mathematical equations. But in any event, in the first week of quantitative economics, the lecturer announced that there'd be an election for the class representative. Tony and I both nominated for no reason other than youthful high spirits. We had no program, no idea what the staff student committee was going to do. In fact, it didn't do anything, as I found out. And we both made a speech the next week against each other. We hadn't met each other. Tony gave a very witty, funny, clever speech, parodied the style of the lecturer. He wrote hieroglyphics on his overhead projector, just like the lecturer did. I gave a very dull, earnest, plodding speech. And modesty forbids me from telling you who won that election. But you would have to say that any politician who could lose an election to me is a long way from infallible. And then we met that afternoon, again, Tony and I, at the first meeting of the Sydney University Democratic Club, which was BA Santa Maria's aligned group. And I thought Tony was a surfer type, sandy hair and so fit and so on. I thought he was an empty-headed surfer type. He thought I was a lefty. We found that we had quite a bit in common after all, although he couldn't have been less like me in the sense that he was a super self-confident alpha male, friendly and already playing top-grade rugby union and a great sportsman and so forth. Anyway, we became great friends and we spent the next couple of years battling the extreme left in student politics. This was a great education and I had the great privilege of becoming friends with a lot of people from all the mainstream parts of Australian politics, because the far left controlled student politics then, an amalgam of independent leftists, communists, Maoists, pro-Soviet communists and Trotskyists controlled the Australian Union of Students. They had very weird policies. At one stage they sent out compulsorily collected money to the Viet Cong. At another stage they sent it to the PLO. And at one stage they had a policy that all men were complicit in the crime of rape, and they defined men as being a male over the age of 7. So, 7, you're an innocent little boy. At 8, you're a rapist. Bad luck, fella. And this was completely bonkers, of course, and we were outraged. You know, the great Yugoslav philosopher Milovan Djilas says the beginning of everything is moral outrage. Well, Tony and I and others were outraged that this mob of extremists was taking our money and using our name and so on. So Tony and I became very active in student politics and we formed an alliance, or we were part of an informal alliance, with all the mainstream groups, really. Labor Party people, Liberals, Jewish student groups, Evangelical student groups, the NCC groups, and a lot of independent students who just didn't like extremists. Most students, quite sensibly, had no interest in student politics, and the left created a sub culture that was so violent and intimidatory and unpleasant that most students kept well away from it, which is how the left liked it, really. They just wanted the students' money. And we eventually determined that we'd try to get campuses to break away from AUS, to disaffiliate, to deny it money. Tony was very successful. In his second attempt, he was elected president of the Students' Representative Council in the biggest vote in the history of the university up till then. Now, that's remarkable for a guy who had his political views, although his political views certainly weren't extreme, but they were conservative by student standards. At one point, he had a strategy that we should take over the Sydney University Liberal Club. We were the Sydney University Democratic Club, and he and I wrote all the leaflets the club put out in 1977, generally under a joint byline. I don't know how we managed that without coming to blows, because we had the Irish disease to an advanced degree. We agreed on 99% of everything and fought furiously about the 1% that we disagreed on. But we took over the Liberal Club, which was very easy, and we thought they were a bunch of dilettantes, really, who only engaged in wine and cheese nights. And as we took it over at the meeting, they said, well, we said this to them, they said, what are you going to do? Have beer and prawn nights instead. We thought, yep, that sounds pretty good. Beer and prawn sounds a good idea. And as for a minute, for 1 second, I was the senior vice president of the Sydney University Liberal Club. So I immediately wrote to the then Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, saying, I want to come and see you, and I want you to change the law so that we no longer have to give our money compulsorily to the Australian Union of Students. We have voluntary membership of AUS, and blah, blah, yakety yak. And I lectured him with all the vim and vigour of a 21-year-old man full of certitude. And he wrote back and said, OK, I'll see you next week. Come down to Canberra, 10:45 a.m, blah, blah, blah. But just at that moment, one of the unions very much influenced by the National Civic Council, the Shop Assistants Union, was having a big, complicated internal brawl in New South Wales. And its officials had led all the union members away from the federal union, and they were going to amalgamate with the Building Workers Industrial Union, which was led by the pro-Soviet Pat Clancy. What has pro-Soviet got to do with shop assistants? God alone knows. So all of a sudden, the federal shop assistants union needed a whole team of industrial organisers and staff to run their campaign to bring back the 40,000 New South Wales shop assistants. They offered me a job as an industrial organiser. Well, of course, who's going to say no to that? What fun that is. So I immediately joined the Shop Assistants Union as an industrial organiser. I had to write back to Malcolm Fraser saying, my dear Prime Minister, thank you so much for your invitation, but I find that I'm otherwise engaged next week. I didn't really feel that I could explain to him I'd become a union official. And the union, although in those days those unions weren't affiliated with the Labor Party, the union leadership said to us officials we should all join the Labor Party if we possibly can. And like a lot of Sydney families, my father had a cousin and a brother, we call them both uncles. One uncle was a minor office bearer in the Liberal Party. One uncle ran a whole Labor machine on the Central Coast, was very important in Barry Cohen's pre-selection in the Labor Party, and my father was a very active DLP supporter. And between the three of them, there was not a cigarette paper's difference in political philosophy. They just happened to be in three different political parties. So Tony Abbott and I drove up to the Central Coast. I joined Uncle Tony's branch. He was very happy to have me because he was under siege from the left-wing steering committee. And at our first branch meeting that I attended, the steering committee had the numbers, but Uncle Tony wasn't going to let that result in them taking over. So he found some procedural reason to declare the meeting over. They tried to storm the stage, but luckily among his supporters was a family of circus wrestlers. So we repelled the invasion of the steering committee. On that night, Rome triumphed over Moscow. The muscular Mensheviks repelled the Bolshevik invasion, and we were triumphant. Now, joining the Labor Party was slightly complicated, given that I had been a member of the Young Liberals and Senior Vice President of the Sydney University Liberal Club and in the Democratic Clubs at Macquarie University and Sydney University. My membership was reviewed by no less a figure than John Ducker, who was then the head of the Labor Council, and Michael Eason. And they surveyed my record, all this relentless anti-communist activism, and they said to each other, this is the sort of young man we want in the Labor Party. They gave me a tick and welcomed me in. And I tell you what, in those days, the New South Wales Labor Party was a pretty good Labor Party, let me tell you. And I remained a member of the Labor Party while I was a shop assistants union official for 18 months or so. We had great brawls with the Building Workers Industrial Union. We pulled back the members, and it was tremendous fun. I loved working with shop assistants. They were very conservative people, very sensible. I tried to lead one strike, but management collapsed before we actually got to go out on the grass over the very vexed issue. They were going to make my members wear pricing guns on their hips, and the good ladies of that Flemings thought that that was rather insulting to their dignity and made them feel like Annie Oakley, and I was willing to bring the retail industry to its knees over this issue. And while I was a union official, I was freelancing for the Bulletin under the pen name of Lance Millard and freelancing for the Australian under the pen name of Paul Mann. It's all getting a bit confusing, but I kept track of it more or less. And I kept approaching Trevor Kennedy and saying, come on, give me a job, give me a job. Finally, he relented and hired me. And some years later, I said to him, so Trevor, that was great of you to hire me. I'd only had a couple of articles published and didn't really have any background. Why did you do it? And he said, well, mate, I could see that you had that unpleasant, quarrelsome, difficult personality which is so essential for success in journalism. And I loved him when he said that. I said, Trevor, nobody has ever said a kinder word to me. And, I felt he was my brother or my uncle. Kennedy produced a remarkable bulletin because he had a philosophy of hiring people who did not have conventional journalistic backgrounds, but who he thought had something to say. So he hired Malcolm Turnbull and Bob Carr, and after I left, I recommended that Tony Abbott go and work there, and Trevor hired Tony Abbott too. He hired John Edwards, who went on to the Reserve Bank board. He hired Gary Sturgis, who became chief of the Cabinet Office or whatever he was under the Greiner government. It was a remarkable newsroom, the Bulletin. And then the rest, as they say, is history. At the Bulletin, I became very good friends with Bob Carr and have remained friends with him ever since, although I disagree with his current position on the Middle East. He was an enormously witty, funny guy, Bob Carr. He used to tease me for being a Santa Maria supporter because he had all the dirt files on me from the Labor Party headquarters. Santa once wrote a column saying Europe hadn't been the same since the fall of the Habsburgs. So I walked into the office that morning and Bob Carr greeted me with, ah, here's Sheridan. He wants to bring back the Habsburgs. Let's hear it for the Habsburgs, Carr said. He leapt on a desk and said, all over Europe, people are saying, bring back the Habsburgs, Santa Maria and Sheridan, and so forth. It was all great fun. I mean, we did actually get paid for this. It's remarkable, but there you go. It was enormous fun. Now, just to conclude, I've got 2 minutes, and then I finished the book. When I joined the Australian in 1984 under the auspices of Les Hollings and John Wheeldon, another great bloke, like Jack Cain, very extraordinary Australian of his generation. I finished the book the year after I joined the Australian. I get appointed as the first ever Beijing correspondent for the paper, and it finishes in China, where I become the first journalist ever to be briefed by Kevin Rudd, who was a junior diplomat at the time. And clearly, I made this experience so pleasant for Kevin that he never stopped doing it. Thereafter, he spent the rest of his life briefing journalists. And think, if I'd been mean to him, you know, the world might have been a different place. But I want to make one or two, in just one sentence, substantive points to you to conclude. When the NCC unions... the NCC still exists, but it's a shadow of its former self, and Gerard charts magnificently in his splendid book What Happened to the NCC. But when the NCC unions went back into the Labor Party, they did so under Bob Hawke's guidance and a very conscious strategy by Bob Hawke to change the nature of the Labor Party. But it had this, and this happened in the early 80s, 83 or 84, it had this odd consequence. It was in their interests, and it was in the interests of their sponsors in the Labor Party, not to talk much about their NCC background. The NCC also had an internal split where the union split away from Santa Maria, but it is to Santa Maria's credit that he didn't leak material trying to discredit those unions after they'd gone back to the Labor Party. However, it led to the NCC being kind of whited out of much Australian history. For example, I reveal in the book that a very famous NCC union official, Mike O'Sullivan, a fine guy, used to write industrial relations reports for the Bulletin under the name Joe Manton for several years. These were brilliant pieces, so brilliant that in the official histories of those years, in the early 70s, Joe Manton is often quoted, but nobody has ever known who Joe Manton was, because Mike, when he became a respectable figure in mainstream Labor, never talked about his past. When Jim Maher, the national leader of the Shop Assistants Union, died, there were obituaries of him in the mainstream press, and they didn't mention his NCC affiliation. So the enormous role that these people played in history was kind of wiped out, as it were. And the other point I'd make is, although Santa Maria was an equivocal figure in some respects, and he had many flaws, and I totally disagreed with his economics in the last period of his life and so forth, I'm happy to acknowledge all his flaws, but he was very kind to me, he's a very big influence on me intellectually, and he was a good example because he never took a backward step, and he was a very important influence on Tony Abbott as well. Although he had many flaws, the NCC actually had enormous institutional consequences in Australian life. A large number of big trade unions were seriously anti-communist because of the NCC. It played a very big role in Laurie Short's triumph in the Iron Workers Union and in a lot of other unions. It also kept the communists under pressure and under challenge all the time in the unions that they did control. I detail in the book efforts I was involved in tangentially to take the Amalgamated Metalworkers Union off the communists and so on. It also, for a time, had five DLP senators and regularly got 10% of the national vote in the Senate. And Santa Maria had important institutional and personal connections in Southeast Asia. And some tens of thousands of people passed through the NCC. One weakness of Santa Maria was that he didn't allow alternative leaders to emerge within the NCC. But many of the good people who passed through it went on to be very significant in Australian life, starting with the Prime Minister. And there are a lot of people now in the Labor Party and in the Liberal Party who are NCC alumni. There's a very distinguished institution, the Sydney Institute, which is headed by an NCC alumnus. The foreign editor of a national newspaper is an NCC alumnus. And I would just make a general point that when you judge this organisation, which is virtually unheard of in Australian discourse today, you have to look at those broad institutional consequences. And the DLP achieved many things. It certainly was important in the state aid debate and in the defence debate, and it kept Labor out of office for a long time. So there are a lot of big institutional consequences there. So in any event, I hope this tale in the book is a bit of fun anyway. It was quite fun to write, although I wrote it in a compressed period under Stalinist rule at home, not allowed to leave the study until I'd done a certain number of words. And I hope that if you buy it, you'll enjoy it. And I think we're going to have some discussion now.
Many thanks, Greg, for an illuminating and funny talk. So we've got, Janet Grundy's got copies of When We Were Young and Foolish, and I'm sure Greg would be happy to sign any after the event. And so we come to questions and discussion. We've got till the top of the hour. I'm going to give Anne this microphone to help, and I'll help at this end and you can help at that end. So can I just go back and ask you a personal question? Your time as a journalist, I mean, it's great fun at the Bulletin. I mean, you're there with Bob Carr and others that you mentioned, but as you know, it's a weekly magazine that's not very large. And did anyone ever do any work? Did anyone ever put in more than 400 words a week?
Look, that's a very fair question, Jared. And I think the best way to understand the Bulletin, really, is to read the Bertie Wooster short stories of T.G. Wodehouse and focus on the Drones Club. You know, so the key topic of conversation each morning was lunch and where we were going to go for lunch. And the key topic of the conversation in the afternoon was what lunch had been like, really. But it is true that everybody there was a marvellously eccentric place. Bob Carr used to say it was a sort of an ideological zoo. He'd say, walk through here, see the old-style Labor man, Alan Reid, bitter at the way Labor has gone. Remark over there, the free marketeer and evangelist of pure economics, Peter Samuel. Here is a social democrat, Bob Carr. There is a refugee from Santa Maria. But everybody had their own projects. Bob Carr was organising his pre-selection from the minute I got there. Robert Drew, who was on the staff, was, of course, writing his novels. I think I may have been writing for News Weekly under a pen name. I can't quite recall. Jack Kane had a newsletter called Industrial Data, which was a way of companies donating money to the NCC. Jack would produce this newsletter, which was full of insider gossip about trade union matters. And every now and again, the staffer who did it for him, Kevin Davis, was away sick or on leave or something. And either, mostly me, but sometimes our beloved Prime Minister, used to deputise for Kevin Davis when Kevin was away, so we'd go into Jack's office and ring a couple of sympathetic union officials, get a bit of tidy gossip on the ACTU or something, and write this newsletter, and companies would pay money for it. And, you know, once when I just started work at The Australian, Les Hollings called me into the office and said, look, mate, I've got something very interesting for you to read here. You can't take it away or photocopy it because the company pays good money for this, but I want you to read it and use it as the basis for an editorial. And I read it. It was an Industrial Data newsletter that I'd written myself. But the final point on Jared's point is, I think we did recognise The Australian tried very hard to hire Bob Carr, who was a brilliant, brilliant journalist, probably the best journalist out of that gang. And Bob had already decided he was going into Parliament, so he said no. And their very meagre consolation prize was me. And when I was tossing up whether to do it or not, Bob said to me, you can't be a serious long-term journalist and work for a weekly magazine with short articles only and pretend that that's a full-time job. You have to go and work for a daily newspaper. So, I mean, that bears out the burden of your question, I think.
Just stay here. So, there's a question here.
I'm just wondering, why do you use... I'm just interested, why does one use pen names?
Why did you use pen names?
Well, it was very simple in my case. I was a trade union official, and trade union officials were not really supposed to be writing articles of political commentary. I mean, Joe, the national person who later became National Secretary of the SEA was Joe De Bruin. I worked for Joe. Joe is a really fine man. He is an outstanding individual. I must say he was the hardest boss I ever had, you know. He made me arrive at factory gates spruce in a suit and clean-shaven at 6:30 if there was a shift beginning at 7, just to show the members that if they were at work, we were at work. I hadn't seen 6:30 in my life, except coming through from the night before. I mean, the idea that you would get up out of bed and go to a, you know, we had drug... We didn't only cover shop assistants, we covered drug-making factories and warehouse facilities and so forth. And this was a shocking business, but the... As a union official, you weren't supposed to be telling the government how to run its affairs or something like this. Joe was going to send... We did affiliate to the Labor Council, and Joe was going to send me along as a delegate on behalf of the union, and his instruction was the same instruction that had been given to my father all those years before. Go along on behalf of the SDA, vote the way we tell you to, and shut up. And luckily, I left the union before that I ever got to go to a Labor Council meeting on behalf of the union. Who knows whether I would have followed that instruction or not.
Ida.
Regarding Bob Carr, why do you think he changed his views drastically on the Middle East?
Well, I've written columns about that, and I disagree with Bob's current position on the Middle East, but I don't want to impute any motives into him. He's explained it himself. I think it's enough to say that I completely disagree with his current position on Israel and the Middle East. I accept his own explanation of his own change in thinking. And I'm glad that we've remained friends, even though we have a strong disagreement on that. And I've really been blessed in life to have friends on both sides of politics. And I do think we need to be civil with each other in Australian public debate, if we can. So that's a way of just dodging your question, really.
We've got plenty of time and plenty of questions. So,
thank you very much. We know that the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. The historical experiment of communism has failed historically. Do you think that nowadays there are still some circles which dream of communism? Do you think about communism and would like to have something like communism?
Well, I know one person does, Vladimir Putin, because he said so. He said that the fall of communism was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. But I would use your question to make a more general point about the Cold War. This is a book about the politics of the Cold War in part as they played out in Australia. I'm glad that we won the Cold War. I'm glad there are no longer thousands of Soviet nuclear missiles aimed at the West and some of them at us. But the end of the Cold War has meant a kind of collapse in purpose in Western politics, especially in social democratic parties. Centre-left parties, it seems to me, around the world now are going far further to the left than they used to. And the Cold War did impose certain disciplines on everyone. One reason we were all friends across mainstream politics at student level was because we had a common enemy, the communists. You know, whatever your disagreements between Labour and Liberal, they were as nothing compared to your disagreement with the communists. That's all gone now. All that discipline is gone. All that sense of purpose is gone. And also a lot of the lessons that we learned in the Cold War, the importance of alliances, the importance of values in foreign policy, the possibility of treachery, the way an extremist ideology can appeal even to otherwise sensible people. I mean, at its height, the Communist Party in Australia had 23,000 members. And this was when we knew that it was an engine of mass murder, of an unprecedented scale in human history. How could any rational human being support communism? Yet we know that many highly intelligent people, Burgess, Blunt, Philby, MacLean and so forth, defected from the cause of liberal democracy to communism because it was a strong ideology, strongly presented. And I think some of these lessons are as relevant today as they were in the Cold War.
Lindsay.
Julia Gillard excused a youthful discretion on the grounds that she was young and naive. And you used the expression young and foolish. Which is preferable, to be naive or foolish? And which is the most foolish thing that you did in those days?
Well, you know, God, there's such a cavalcade of foolish things. And, of course, I don't want to imply that I ceased ever being foolish when I ceased being young. But I'm very happy with the historic causes that we embraced and the things we stood for. I'm not ashamed of any of our positions in those days. We were against the communists. I think that's a pretty sensible thing to do. In World War II, being anti-Nazi was about 98% of what you needed for a decent political program. I think in the Cold War, being anti-communist was about 80% of what you needed for a decent political program. When Saigon fell, that was a very bitter moment, because we knew what the communists would do, the Vietnamese and the Cambodians. We didn't know it in any detail, but we knew from all the experience of communism what it would be like. The left in this country completely lost interest in the Indochinese once the Americans were defeated. And Tony Abbott and I wrote a lot of news, a lot of issues of Democrat, and another friend, Tony Rogers, a barrister, urging the government to take in Indochinese refugees, urging the government to do something to try to oppose the atrocities and the genocide that was happening in Cambodia by the Cambodian communists. No one on the left had the slightest interest in this. Gough Whitlam was hostile to Indochinese refugees and the left hated them. And I'm not unhappy with any of the positions we took, but any of the big positions. I mean, we might have, you know, got plenty of tactics wrong. But if you look at discrete acts of foolishness, there were a million. Let me offer you just one. At an AUS conference, Tony and I and two other blokes went to a PLO film night because we thought the AUS had no business using our money to put on a propaganda film night in favour of terrorists. And so we went to the film night and we heckled the film. We weren't rude, we didn't use four-letter words or anything, we weren't violent or anything like that. But nonetheless, four modestly conservative young blokes in an audience of 40 or 50 committed PLO supporters is fairly stupid. The PLO supporters didn't like the odds. I think they felt they could deal with the three of us pretty well, but Tony did play first grade rugby union and they were a bit coarse, so they called in another 20 or 30 reinforcements. And at this point I was saying to our beloved Prime Minister, mate, I think we've probably made our point now. I think we could retire gracefully. You know, I don't think there'd be any loss of honour here if we just left. And he was saying, no, mate, no, they've got no right to keep us out. We've got every right to be here. And eventually the other two and I prevailed over the Prime Minister and he acknowledged the wisdom in collective leadership, and we scooted out at the last minute. So that was certainly a moment of foolishness.
Paul.
Yeah. Greg, the collective ideology that you've talked about, do you see that as being part of the rise of corruption in the union movement? I mean, when I was in the unions, there were a couple of blokes who everybody knew were on the take, but virtually not generally at all. There was very little real corruption. And it seems to me that the collapse of ideology has allowed the fact that you're saying that the show people, the NCC people, were keeping the hard left honest, and they were also keeping us honest. That's gone. Do you see that as a contributor to the corruption in the unions?
Look, to be honest with you, I don't know to what extent unions are corrupt. There have obviously been some very high-level cases recently. You know, the human condition never changes, and the temptation to corruption if you have unsupervised or unaccounted or unscrutinised power is always there. There's a long history of corruption in American unions, but there also is in corporations. I wouldn't single unions out in this respect. And I don't write about industrial relations these days. I mean, in the 1970s and in the early 80s, I had a very good idea of who was who in the zoo of Australian trade unions. I just have to plead that I only really just read the newspapers. I've been scandalised by some of the things that have come out of the Royal Commission. But I also know there are, you know, a tremendous number of honest, hard-working, decent and certainly not corrupt union officials. I tell you what, when we worked for the Shop Assistants Union, you could not bill a paddle pop to the union. You know, on one occasion I wanted to do some photocopying that was unrelated to the union. And I said to Joe De Bruin, is it all right if I photocopy this document? You know, it's not related to union business. And he paused and thought very seriously whether he should allow this terrible abuse of union funds. And he said, eventually said, well, yes, all right, but don't make a habit of it. And that, I think, was the only financial consideration any of us ever took at the SDA. Whatever else the SDA was, it was certainly not financially corrupt. But I didn't know of any financial corruption in unions. And a lot of the communists were certainly not financially corrupt. A lot of them were very dedicated to their very evil ideology.
Dennis?
How important was the fight against communism at Sydney University?
Well, I think it was important in several ways. One, it was important in itself because, you know, extremists ran Sydney University student politics and ran the Australian Union of Students. And not everyone was an extremist, not everyone involved was an extremist, not everyone on the left was an extremist. There were moderate people on the left as well as extreme people. But the extremists had the upper hand. So it was very important to break that. I also do think it contributed to a very fine generation of political leaders. Not only the people I've talked about at length tonight, but people like Peter Costello. You know, Peter Costello had his arm broken in an attack by extreme left-wingers. Michael Danby was hospitalised after an attack by Maoist thugs and, you know, underwent extensive neurological tests and so on. Well, it bred a certain steel in these people, which I think was very valuable in their subsequent careers. However, no victory is permanent, and having defeated the communists, there are lots of other folks who have bad intentions for our society now. But I do think it was an important thing, and it was good that people were active in it.
Just down there.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Curry. I'm interested in your views of what might happen in China. I've been talking to a lot of Chinese who left during the Cultural Revolution, and they're frightened because of the current situation. They see a trend of liquidating, say, property developers, and they are worried there are so many vacant cities, and they see the contrast between the peasants with very little and the property developers, and what they're anticipating is loans will be called and perhaps a command economy will re-emerge where peasants are given these vacant cities in order to drive domestic demand internally. Now, that's a far, you know, that's a far-fetched scenario, but what is your read on what might evolve out of the Chinese problems?
Well, I was a correspondent in China in 1985. I remember Gerard was there with John Howard and had the propensity to ask very awkward questions like human rights and politics and what were the consequences of the Cultural Revolution. But this is a very big and complex subject. I could bore you rigid with hours on it. But in short, I think the Chinese are transitioning from a very heavy investment-led economic model to a more consumer-spending economic model. However, they are not going to become a free market economy like Australia or the United States. It seems to me they have pioneered a new model, which is state-led semi-capitalism, with state-owned enterprises still holding the commanding heights, and notionally private enterprises, which are absolutely in the service of the state, holding the commanding heights of the economy. They have also posed a very robust challenge to democracy. I mean, all my life I've believed that freedom was a universal good, and that economic freedom and political freedom went hand in hand and they delivered better societies. I still believe that. I believe it in principle and in practice. However, it's difficult now to go to a young man in Shanghai who certainly wants more freedom, but to say to him, now, if only your society were as well governed as Western societies like Greece or Spain. Democracy is not doing very well at the moment, and that hasn't removed my faith in democracy, but our prestige has declined, partly because our performance has declined. After the Tiananmen massacre in 1989, most analysts felt that the Chinese people had a propensity for liberalism and democracy, although a great deal of the sentiment driving the Tiananmen massacres was resentment at corruption, that the Red Prince's sons have opportunities that my sons don't have. Very deliberately, the Chinese government fashioned a nationalist sentiment within their people, an extreme nationalist sentiment. That is now a real sentiment, but it has been exaggerated and amplified and developed deliberately by the government as the chief ideological sentiment of modern Chinese. I do think the Chinese government has given us rational policy on the whole. And you have to acknowledge the fact that hundreds of millions of people have exited from poverty under the leadership of this government, and that's nothing to be sneezed at. I don't think they'll have that much trouble remaining stable because they're very sanguine about repressive measures. They have the legitimisation of nationalism, they have a lot of people who are doing very well, and they have a lot of resentment at inequality, but they're also very good at repression. If there's another Tiananmen moment, they will resolve it in the way the last one was resolved. So my overall prediction would be they're in for a bit of a bumpy ride economically, but I guess that they'll hang together.
Greg, as someone who's a former alumni of some of those groups you describe, albeit a much older one, I want you to go back and think about the man who is now our Prime Minister, Tony Abbott. Something of what you've described about your young and foolish days, we still see within Tony Abbott in terms of his determination to fight to the end against all odds, whatever. How much do you think he has changed since those days? How much do you think some of his characteristics that we see now that a lot of the media don't understand, how much is there still in him, and what do you think he will do for his prime ministership?
Well, and, poor old Tony shouldn't really have to bear my friendship like a millstone around his neck. And, you know, I'm as unqualified as the next man to make psychiatric evaluations about him. But I would say that certainly the caricature of the Prime Minister, that he's a knuckle-dragging Visigoth, a barbaric hardliner, is completely bananas. In my view, the key to him in many ways is that he's an incurable romantic, and he invests in people and causes very profoundly and is too late to leave them. You know, one of the figures in the book is the great Melbourne political philosopher, Frank Knoffelmacher. And I went to see Frank with Michael Danby once. He gave me a read on the NCC type and the Irish type. And although Tony's certainly not Irish, he comes from that culture of Irish-Australian Catholicism. And Frank said to me, I know what you NCC people are really like, you know. You are one half altar boy, very devout, and one half ruthless, murderous gangster. And I think there's something in what Brandon had to say. He had a read on the Irish too. He said, I understand the Irish temperament. There is no cause which is too lost for you to embrace. You always buy a ticket on the last train into a city which is about to be evacuated. And I think those two suggestions of Franta offer some suggestive insight into the Prime Minister. The other thing I'd say is that the Prime Minister had been systematically vilified by the left in Australia since he was 19, because they recognised then that he had the capacity to win and you couldn't intimidate him. And all Conservative leaders in Australian history have been vilified by the left. Pig Iron Bob, Shane Fraser Shane, Little Johnny Howard, and none of them really has resembled the caricature of popular mythology. Whether the Prime Minister has the capacity, I mean, he has his own limitations as a political communicator and so on, whether he has the capacity to break out of the current difficulties and succeed, I don't know. But I certainly know he bears no resemblance to the popular caricature of him.
Now we're coming very close to him. We've got Michael Bone. Michael?
Following Anne's question, the success of the Labor Party in, if you like, recreating a totally different Tony Abbott to the one you know and describe and the one many of us know. Firstly, how did it and why did it succeed in your view? And secondly, what can be done? What can he do or what can be done generally to, if you like, represent the real Tony Abbott?
That reminds me of one of Santa's great lines. I think this may be apocryphal. Jared will know, but Santa used to say, you know, Lenin said the only question which counts is what is to be done. And I don't know if Lenin ever did say that. I have no idea. Santa might have been making it up, but it's such a great quote. It should be true, even if it's not. You know, why was the left successful? Partly because they are very persistent. They're very dedicated, the left. Their lives are politics, not religion and not other things. It's all politics. And they are relentless in doing it. The other thing is, Tony does have his own limitations as a communicator. He tends to resort easily to military and sporting metaphors, and they're less appealing now to people than they used to be. The other thing is, I'd say to you honestly, there has always been a bit of anti-Catholic sentiment in Australia. In some respects, it's less now than it used to be. In some respects, it's worse now than it used to be. You are allowed in public life to be a social justice Christian. That is to say, you can be a left-wing Christian and you won't be marked down for being a Christian. You're allowed to be Tim Costello. You are not allowed to be a conservative Christian and you know, talk fairly shamelessly about this. And sometimes there's something guileless in the way Tony talks about his Catholicism. I think it's almost getting to the point where we Catholics should stop calling ourselves Catholics and call ourselves Christians, because it's a more sort of inclusive term, whereas, of course, we always like to be sectarian and identify with our tribe. But, you know, you add those and a million other things together. And but mind you, the media is rough on any conservative leader. They may love, you know, this person or that person now, but if they get into the leadership, you'll soon find that you know, Crikey and everybody else discovers all the skeletons which don't really exist in their closets. And what can be done about it? I don't know. I wish the Prime Minister had a more expansive communication strategy. Mm-hmm. I wish he talked more to us, that he went in more unscripted ways on television and all that. There's a certain danger in that, but given where he is in the polls and so on, I think you've got to accept a few dangers to triumph in the end.
Now we're running out of time. Malcolm, sorry, Malcolm. Malcolm, you should have a loud voice. Last question.
Last question is, given that Rupert Murdoch had a bust of Lenin in his room at Oxford University, do you think he's got a book in him when we were young?
Look, you'll find this almost impossible to believe, but Rupert Murdoch is perhaps the only person to whom I don't give public advice. And, but quite a lot of books have been written about Rupert, and you know, as Paul Keating once said, you know, you're a sad bloke if you've got to write a book about yourself, aren't you?
So tell us briefly, finally, about yourself, because this is a memoir that sort of stopped 30 years ago. Is there another one? Is there another one in the study?
Sequel.
Well,
sequel.
I'd say this, Jared, and the ladies in the audience might forgive me, but I find that writing and producing a book is as near as a bloke gets to childbirth, really. There's a long, unpleasant, stoic period of gestation. Then there is a climax of agonising pain. God, will it or won't it emerge? Will it stop? Will it ever stop? Oh, God! And then finally it stops, and you think, God, I'm never going to do that again. And then you fall in love with the progeny. And you think, what a clever little fellow he is. How much I like him. And gradually you forget the pain, and in a few years you find yourself in exactly the same predicament as you were in before. At the moment, the pain is still quite vivid in my memory, so I suspect it might be 10 or 15 years, depending on JC's cooperativeness, I suspect. However, I urge you to wait in expectation for that moment. Thank you very much.
A lively and witty and thoroughly enjoyable night tonight, and best wishes for the success of When We Were Young and Foolish. Thanks again to the NAB, and we'd love to have you back in 15 years' time, and I'm sure the NAB would be happy to host you. Dallas McInerney says yes. So, well done, and thanks a lot, and we'll see you again in the future. Thanks. Bye.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.